I don't know if it was me searching for stories that has hope, or it was these stories that were finding me. I don't know, to be honest, who needed the other the most. But even during a genocide, a war, ethnic cleansing and displacement and everything, I tried to show the kindness of the people, to show the Palestinians living in Gaza who they are, how they are kind to one another, how they are nice even during these difficult times.
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today I sit down with Palestinian journalist and storyteller, Palestia Al-Aqad. Palestia has become one of the most identifiable faces from the Gaza Strip. At just 22 years old, the young journalism graduate began documenting her daily life after October 7 as Israeli bombs destroyed the world around her. Quickly, she and a handful of others became our access point into the personal and insurmountable trauma on the ground. It was a way to tell stories we had never experienced before. Immediate, intimate, unfiltered, through the voices of young Palestinians who, like Palestia, were experiencing the fifth major war of their short lives. Palestia and her close family were eventually able to leave Gaza in November, traveling to Australia to stay with relatives, but she continues to document the situation back home as best she can, to keep the spotlight from shifting away from those who could not make it out. But in another world, in another reality, Palestia would have had a chance at childhood, a chance to imagine a future that didn't demand her to be a professional witness to the suffering of her people. When we met in Melbourne, she had just performed poetry on stage at the Bankstown Grand Slam, something she had been passionate about for years. And I asked her to read us some of her work, and to my great joy, she agreed. It's of course impossible to talk about anything without centering Gaza. But there are moments where the light shines through, where we get to see Palestia, the storyteller, the animal lover, the young optimist with big dreams. So what does she dream for herself? And is that future open to her now? So Palestia, welcome to The Big Picture. It's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me where we are right now. Where are we having this conversation?
In Australia.
In Australia.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's insane. It's a very far away from Gaza, from
Palestine, everywhere.
From the rest of the world. That's true. That's very true. Why are we having this conversation here?
Why?
Why? Why are you here?
Why am I here in Australia? Because there's a genocide back home.
Hmm. And you've been here for how long?
2 months or more. I don't know, like December, January, February, almost 3 months now. But the thing is, at first when you asked me, I wanted to say 2 weeks because It feels like 2 weeks. But actually, it's 3 months or maybe 3 months and a half. But time flies in a crazy way. Like, I don't even understand anything.
Yeah, it is really difficult to understand how long it's been. How long it's been since you started telling stories and since people started watching your stories. And it feels like it was just yesterday or just a few days ago.
It's been almost half a year now.
And I want to talk to you about your time telling these stories. And I want to talk to you about your own writing and your own poetry. And I was thinking about how to start this conversation. And I have a good friend of mine. He is a great poet by the name of Ken Arkind. And one of the things he says is that your name is the first story that you tell someone when you meet them. So I want to ask you to tell us, what is the story of your name? What does Palestia mean? Where does it come from?
Okay, so my name always opens up a conversation about Palestine, because my dad named me, by the way. So Palestia comes from one of the first tribes that ever lived in Palestine. So my name is even related to Palestine. So whenever I meet any person, they always ask me, what does your name mean? Then we start talking about Palestine. So that has always been my favorite part.
So it is related to the word Palestine.
Yeah. My dad loves reading. He's always reading like history books. So he was reading, then he was like, yeah, that's your name.
Do you know where the word comes from?
Yeah, it comes from a tribe called Philistia, if I'm not mistaken. So my name is Philistia.
Philistia as in Philistine.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's all connected.
It is all connected. So you are, in a way, carrying the story of Philistine with you.
Exactly.
In your name. And when did you start thinking about yourself as a storyteller?
Since a young age. One thing about me is I never shut up in my house. My mom used to take Panadol. I think she still secretly takes Panadol because I'm always talking. My mom used to always tell me, how do you always have something to say? Even when meeting people for the first time, I always have a story to share, something to tell. I love stories in general. Also, one thing I consider myself lucky is, like, here's our house and here's my grandparents' house. Like, we live in the same floor, same building, different apartments. So anyway, my grandpa, my grandma, especially my grandpa, he used to always tell us a story since a young age. Sometimes my mom is just out with her friends, or she's working, or she's busy, and I was with my grandpa, and he's telling us stories about the Nakba, about his dog, because in Palestine, but like he died now. He used to always tell us stories. So when you're surrounded by good storytellers, I think you become a storyteller without even noticing. Like, this is the first time that I actually think about it.
And so you absorbed a lot of these stories when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And then you became yourself a storyteller.
And I became the person who's telling the stories that my grandpa used to tell me. Like, I used to always tell my friends, like, Sido told me so and so and so.
Like, tell me, what's an example of a story that you tell a lot?
Okay, he used to always tell me about his dog. I love dogs a lot, by the way. And Sido, now he passed away, may his soul rest in peace, he used to love dogs. So he told me how he had a dog and how he always played with his dogs and how they had, like, a lot of space at house and they played and everything. Then he told me in 1948, a Nakba, when it happened, he left, okay? And the dog didn't, like, the dog stayed because they thought they would return, it's 1 hour, 2 hours, or a day, or a two, or a week, or two, and they would return, but they never actually returned. So he used to always tell me about how he felt leaving his dog behind. But he didn't think that he's leaving his dog behind. He thought he's coming back. And now I just keep thinking of my stuff that I left behind, but I keep thinking that it's okay, we will go back. But even if we went back, they're like half of the people got killed. Almost all the places got demolished. It will never be the same.
And so some of these things that you now maybe didn't think about before, your items, your things, similar to your grandfather's dog, these things are now feel a lot more significant.
100%, especially when I was back in Gaza reporting, there was a safe corridor for people to evacuate from the north to the south. And I used to see many people walking and they... like they have their cats with them. And some of them, they have dogs, but obviously there are more cats than dogs. So whenever I see that, I always think of my grandpa and his dog.
And you, as a kid, you were telling stories in your house, in your grandparents' house. You were telling stories to everybody. You tell stories to your friends.
Till now.
Till now, you're still telling stories. I think a lot of the reason that why we know you is because you're telling stories. And I want to ask you about at what point in time did you start thinking of yourself as a storyteller, as something that defines who you are?
Never.
Never.
Yeah, I never thought of it, to be honest. Okay, so the last months of my life, I'm not thinking. Like, time is just passing, I'm just living, I'm trying my best to post about Palestine, to do interviews, to talk, to attend events and stuff, but I'm not really thinking of what I'm doing. I'm just doing stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's you're running on instinct.
Yeah, like, I didn't take a while to stop and reflect, and I'm like, wow, Plistia, you did so and so, or, oh, you're a reporter now, you're a storyteller. Like, I didn't have this moment of realization or, like, a pause to stop and process what happened or what is still happening. But I'll tell you when I do.
Yeah, no, please do. But people know you as a journalist. And this is something that you studied.
Yeah.
And this is something that you were intending to pursue. I imagine that you didn't think that it would happen in quite the way that it did, with the kind of platform that you suddenly had. But what made you want to become a journalist?
Okay, so I studied in new media and journalism. And what I love a lot about my major is the opportunities and chances that I have. Like, it doesn't limit you. I was in grade 6 when I knew that when I grow up, I want to be a journalist. Okay, so I love writing since a young age. I have diaries, I have journals. I just write. I don't like to gossip about other people. So I have this thing. I have a notebook that it has the names of all the people that I know, like the names of the teachers, like every person I know in my life, they have a page. For example, my teacher, she has a page. Whenever she annoys me, I just write about her. Instead of gossiping and telling other people, I just write. So that was my way in general. And I used to always document the happy moments, the stuff that I want to remember. So I loved writing a lot. And I had a teacher in grade six. She's just, like, she's a journalist and a teacher. And I thought that was so cool. And she used to tell us the stories of her, like, as a journalist, what did she see, some of the reports that she did. And we had certain events in school, and she used to report as a journalist. Now, not as a teacher. So I was like, yeah, that's interesting. I want to do that when I grow up because I love cameras, reporting, TV, like many people watching, like me having the power. Like, I think media is so powerful. You have the power to tell millions of people your story or other people's stories. So that's basically the reason.
And so what were you doing when after you finished studying, while you were studying? Were you trying out different ways of being a journalist? Had you started using your phone as a way of documenting things around you?
Okay, so when I graduated, I was only 20 years old. I graduated in 3 years rather than 4 years. So I was young, and I still wanted like to figure things out. When I graduated from Cyprus, I went back to Gaza, because I always thought that there's a lot in Gaza to see and film. Like, the media doesn't do Gaza justice. We only see the bombs, the airstrikes, the demolishment, but we don't, like, the outer world, they don't know Gazans. They don't know the beauty of the people, the places, and everything, especially as a Gazan Palestinian who studied abroad. People were impressed when I tell them stories about Gaza. They're like, oh, you have such a restaurants? I'm like, yeah, we have swimming pools, we have restaurants, we have cafes, you have internet. So I was, like, surprised how people think we live. So that's why when I graduated, I was like, I want to go back to my homeland and just show people Gaza through my eyes. And the thing is, I always thought I have time. When I graduated, I started like taking different internships in Press House Palestine and different news channel. I was just seeing what type of journalism I want to do. I tried doing a news editor, and I was like, no, I don't want to be like just writing behind the screen. I want to be on camera. I want to interview people. I want to talk to people. I also love marketing, so I also tried working in the marketing industry. I was still figuring things out, you know. Then the 7th of October and the war broke, so I never really had the time to show people the Gaza that I wanted to show them.
And then after the 7th of October, all of a sudden, there is this war that is happening around you. Things are happening very quickly.
Very.
It's hard to understand what's going on, what's happening from day to day. And you have your phone and you have the internet. What did you decide to do in that moment?
From the first day, I was documenting videos. I was filming how we're all sitting in the living room and how it's an emergency case, how we have a bag with the important documents. I filmed this video, but I posted it, I think, as a story, or maybe I didn't. I don't remember. I posted another video the second day, just like the family and what we're doing and how we're all sleeping in the living room. Then on the third day, like, the bombing was so intense to the point that I live in a building, okay? So some apartments in the building I'm in were bombed and we were inside the building. And some apartments caught fire and we were inside the building. Like, can you imagine how intense the sounds and everything was? I just filmed a video and it went viral. And ever since, I continued filming and posting. And that was the thing I was doing since day one, before even going viral. And I love vlogging. And I love vlogging my life in general. Like, I always vlog and film, but I never post.
And because you were filming stuff before that, you had there were some things that you shared from what Gaza looked like before October 7th that you would have been documenting on your phone continuously, right? You had all of this material that you might not have shared all of it, but you had this desire that you wanted to be able to just document things around you.
Yes. I love how people see things differently. Like, for example, you and I, we can report on the same story, mm-hmm. but you will report in your way, I will report on my own different way. So the whole point of me studying journalism and going back home to my homeland, to my country, is to show people Gaza through my eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did even during the war. Like, I don't know if it was me searching for stories that has hope, or it was these stories that were finding me. I don't know, to be honest, who needed the other the most. But even during a genocide, a war, ethnic cleansing and displacement and everything, I tried to show the kindness of the people, to show the Palestinians living in Gaza, who they are, how they are kind to one another, how they are nice even during these difficult times. And I think what makes people in Gaza like a caring and a nice community is the struggles. Because this is not the first time that the war broke. We have, I lived for previous aggressions, and I'm only 22 years old. I'm sure people who are older than me lived even more aggressions and intifadas and everything. So I think the struggles is what brings us together as a community. Like, okay, I'm a thin person, and I lost 5 kilos maybe during the time I was working back in Gaza. And I remember every time I was walking through tents and meeting people, reporting, talking to them, everyone, literally everyone, used to offer me food or a cup of tea or a cup of water or a cup of anything, to the point where even kids were offering me food. So I always ask my colleagues, like, do I look that bad? Like, do I look hungry? But it's nice how people care. It's not about food. It's about how people care about one another. Like, there is this girl, her name is Renda. I remember when I saw her, she like had a sandwich she was eating. And the minute she saw me, like, she gave me her sandwich to eat. So it's cute how people think of one another.
And you were documenting that. Like, I remember that distinctly, because there's so many people that I know that were sharing this story in particular. When you started documenting, oh, today this person gave me this, and this is the food that I'm getting. And I want, like, let's go back to what you were saying before about why you wanted to do journalism and why you wanted to show Gaza and Palestinians in a different light. What do you think about the way that Palestinians are seen that you think is a problem?
Everything about how the world sees Palestinians is a problem.
Everything, the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing is a problem. Yes. I hate how the media, the propaganda, everything that's happening, and I hate how people think Palestinians are born to die. Like, they're born for wars and genocides and demolishment, like, as if this is our life and we should be used to it. Something that I saw a lot, I witnessed a lot during these 5 months, and it really annoyed me, is how when people abroad see Palestinians, they look neat or they look clean or like they are in one piece, they can't sympathize with them the same way when a Palestinian loses a hand or a leg or an eye or like is all injured, because that's their image. They think that's how a Palestinian person should look. Or like a Palestinian person, your job is to die. Like, some people were annoyed when I was able to travel, because like, do you want me to stay and die? Do you think that's my role, to die? So it really bothers me how they view Palestinians in general and how they think this is a role. And how they think Palestine is only demolishment and bombs and airstrikes. Okay, unfortunately, we're under occupation. I can't romanticize life under occupation. But still, despite everything, we Palestinians love our lives in Palestine. I love my life in Gaza. I traveled a lot. I've been to Egypt, I've been to Jordan, to Ireland, to many countries. But at the end of the day, I always go back to my homeland. It's where I belong, you know?
And I mean, in the time that I've spent covering Palestine in particular, one of the things that I've noticed is that people tend to pay attention to what's happening, especially in Gaza, only when the worst case scenario is happening. And that after a while, as you're saying, the only image of Palestinians that people have access to is
dead bodies.
People in the worst moments of their life.
Which, you know, I don't know if you noticed that or not, but I rarely post any graphic content on my Instagram account or like bodies or people amputated, because that's not how we look. Like, it kills me when I see people that I know personally, they're my friends, we're cousins or we're related or anything, and then they got killed and that's how they look. Like, no, don't remember that person in that way. That's not how he or she looked. You know, that's how they got killed, but that's not how they look.
That's not how they lived.
Yeah, that's not how they lived, exactly. So I don't like when these pictures are posted and shared online, like we have to look like that just to convince the world or just to show the world what's happening.
What do you think is the consequence of people only seeing Palestinians through that lens?
Dehumanization. Like, definitely dehumanization. Like, I hate how Palestinians for years or decades now, they have been dehumanized.
Tell me about that. In what way do you think they're being dehumanized?
Like, I'm a human, you're a human, even if we have different nationalities. But other people or some people, they don't see us as humans just because we're Palestinians. Mm. I hate comparisons, but what's happening in Palestine, if it was happening in a Western country, the reaction of the world in general, it would have been way different. Mm. But because it's happening to Palestine and to Palestinians, it's being normalized.
Why do you think Palestinians aren't seen in the same way that, say, people in Ukraine are seeing?
Because of how the media covers Palestine. That's why, like, I'm glad I do have followers in social media, and I get glad and I get happy when people recognize me, not because they recognize Palestine, but because they recognize a Palestinian person, because they're seeing how Palestinians live. Like, now, I'm glad we have social media, or I'm glad we have a new media, not just the old media, so they can see what's happening from eyes of people who are there. Like, for example, I'm a Palestinian. I've been living in Gaza my whole life, and I'm reporting. I'm not just a foreigner journalist who came to report. And it plays a difference.
It does play a difference. I agree with you. And I think that is what is different in a lot of ways about the moment that we're in now. Because it feels like for the very first time, maybe in history, I don't think there's been any other place where that has experienced what the Palestinians are experiencing right now, and where the world has had access to voices like yours and voices of Palestinians, ordinary people in their homes that are able to tell their own stories in that way. Did it feel, when you were there, did it feel like it was a tool or a weapon that you had to be able to tell your story?
It did, but you can't imagine how hard my job is. For example, I used to see many stories that I wanted to report, and I just want to take my film and film what's happening, but I didn't do that because I was always looking, oh, what's the percentage of my phone? Mm-hmm. Because I'm afraid if my battery died, how will I charge my phone again? And it was so difficult to be able to connect to the internet. We don't always have access to the internet. Yeah. We have to use an eSIM. We have to go to certain places to connect to the internet. So, like, being a journalist in a war zone, you can't imagine how difficult it is. And it's even harder and more difficult that we don't have tools. So we have cameras and everything, but the last days we stopped using cameras because of the batteries and it's higher quality. So we started using our phones. And I'm like, what journalist only uses a phone as the main tool? But it was everything we had. And even with the phone, till today, when I look at my gallery and photos, I have videos that I didn't post. It's not that I didn't want to post, but I didn't have that much of internet to post. So whenever I have internet, I'm just like, oh, okay, I just want to post this and that, that I forgot to post many things or I didn't have the chance.
And I remember there would be times when we would be covering what's happening in Gaza, and then there would be an internet blackout, or there would be the communications cut, and for a couple of hours, even some of our own journalists, we don't know where they are, and we don't know if they're okay.
If they're alive.
If they're alive. And so I can only imagine what it must be like trying to communicate. I mean, you're trying to communicate with your family members as well, as I can imagine, using the internet. And you're also trying to communicate things that have happened around you to the world, and that isn't always possible.
It was so challenging, especially during the first 2 weeks. I wasn't with my family. So my family were at a place, and I was staying at the hospital because there I could charge my phone. I was staying at the hospital. They were staying at a different place. And where they were staying, there's no cellular connection at all. Like, I have to call them maybe 10 or 20 times to be able to hear their voices for 2 seconds. Then you stop hearing because of how bad the service is. So it was really challenging, and sometimes I used to feel selfish thinking of how worried my mom must be that I chose to be a journalist. And before traveling, I traveled after almost 46 days, and it wasn't even a decision to travel, you know. And I remember how I was always telling my mom, like, my mom, please, you travel, my sister, my grandma, like, please, I'll stay here with my colleagues. Like,
you wanted to stay.
Yeah, I wanted to stay, and I was always telling my mom that, and my mom was screaming at me. She was so stressed, and she was so done with me.
Yeah.
She was like, the reason I want to travel is you. I don't sleep because I'm worried about you. And, you know, everything a mom would say. She was just expressing her emotions. And it got me thinking how selfish maybe I am, that because I chose to study journalism and to be a journalist, specifically in Gaza, my family, like, they can die, they can get killed any minute just because of a profession I chose. I was always thinking the whole time when I was on the field, we hear ambulance, ambulance the whole time. And I was always looking at the ambulance because I was afraid maybe it's my mom, my sister, my grandma, one of my cousins. I was terrified, especially, like, I would have never forgave myself if something bad happened to them because I'm a journalist. Like, I know many people are getting killed and they're not even journalists. They're just babies. They're just little kids. But knowing the risk of them getting targeted is higher because of my profession made me not sleep at night sometimes. And the thing is, my mom was thinking the whole time when I was out, she used to put a curfew for me sometimes. Like, she thought I'm Cinderella. I'm like, we're in a war zone. And she's like, before El Maghrib, come back. I'm like, it depends when I finish. The last 2 or 3 weeks we were together, like staying at the same place. So she was like putting a curfew and everything. I was like, what's wrong with you? Anyway, and of course I didn't commit to the curfew she gave me because of the situation. Like, I'm not hanging out with my friends, I'm working. So sometimes when I come and I'm late, she's like, I thought that you got killed because I told you to be here at 6. So I directly assumed that you're not here at 7, then she got killed. So I was always thinking how hard being a journalist it is on the journalist itself and on the family and the people around me.
Yeah. And I mean, I can only imagine, you know, your mother, it sounds like she was trying to control the situation around her
as best as she could,
but she couldn't.
Of course.
Yeah. And so why did you want to stay?
Because I'm a journalist, I'm a reporter, and I'm a Palestinian person. So I felt that was my job, that was my duty, especially that I have a voice and people listen to me. So I want to continue to report what's happening. But also, I can't be selfish and just do what I want. I have a family as well that they care about me.
And one thing I'm really curious to ask you is that you spend the first 46 days reporting from the ground, seeing everything that was happening from almost a first-person view. And now you have spent some time on the outside, the furthest place possible from Gaza, with the time zone difference and everything like that. But you have gotten an opportunity to see the way the rest of the world sees Gaza. What have you seen, and what has it made you understand about the situation that you might not have understood before?
Okay, first of all, I feel so selfish saying that, but my mental health now that I'm away, I'm outside, I'm in a safe zone, is way worse than when I was back in Gaza. When I was back in Gaza, my mental health was way better because I'm like, we're all in this together, you know? Whatever will happen to my people, it will happen to me. Like, you can't find food, I can't find food. We're all in this together. But now that I'm far away, it hits hard watching everything that's happening and even watching how the people or how the world views Palestinians or Gazans is even harder, you know. So one thing that surprised me is like how the people, they're protesting, they're boycotting. Like, there are many people with Palestine, they're protesting, they're doing everything they can, but they're feeling helpless as well. So I was surprised when I went out of Palestine how Palestinians, we don't have power, and how the other side is powerful everywhere, basically, and how powerful their media is.
I think that is very accurate. I hear that a lot. I hear a lot from people that feel like they don't know what to do, that they feel very attached to what's happening in Gaza.
Like, everyone wants to help but doesn't know how.
Yeah.
I'm a Palestinian, and people are like, we're so proud of you with everything that you've done. But like, I don't feel the same about myself, if I'm being honest, because everything that I've done feels like an understatement when compared to everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. Like right now, I just keep remembering stories of stuff that happened, and I'm like, I wish I reported on that more. I wish I filmed this and that. But it wasn't even an option. Like, I didn't have tools or cameras or a battery to keep filming the whole time. So when I just remember everything that is happening, and like, it's been, what, almost half a year now, and everything is still happening, and I'm like, what I did is nothing compared to what's happening.
And I think that's very natural for you to feel that way. You were in a situation where you were almost acting on instinct. You know, I don't think you were thinking ahead of you know, strategizing about how you were going to get the message out, or even the idea of like, that you're building an audience and what does that audience expect from you. But when you look back on that now, do you feel a sense of pride in your ability to communicate, your ability to keep telling that story?
I'm glad that I was able, even if to a certain point, to let the world hear the stories of people in Gaza, to give the Palestinians a voice and a platform to share their thoughts, their ideas.
And then now that you're here and you can see how people resonate with those stories, with those voices, I'm just curious. I mean, when you see protests happening here in Australia and other places around the world, they've been happening 4 or 5 months now. There are people that are protesting 2-3 times a week, for example. Is that stuff reaching people in Gaza? Do they know that people are still fighting for them?
Not everyone. For example, me personally, when I was in Gaza, I'm a journalist and I have access to internet. But whenever I open the internet, I just reply to messages from my extended family who are abroad. Okay, we're alive. I just post it quickly. I stop using my phone. I'm panicking. I don't want my phone to die and everything. And there are many people that I know. Like, for example, one of my best friends, it's been a month. She doesn't have internet. I always send her messages on WhatsApp and she doesn't have internet. So people there, they don't always have access to internet to see what's happening. Like me, I was a journalist and I had an internet and I didn't used to see all the protests or all the boycotting that was happening out there. But now that I'm outside of Gaza, I can see how much people are trying their best to stand with Palestine. But till now, unfortunately, nothing has changed. I appreciate everyone who's sharing, posting, protesting, boycotting, and trying his or her best. But it makes me sad that all of that is not enough. Like, for now, almost 30,000 Palestinians, according to the Ministry of Health, got killed. And yet it's not enough for this genocide to stop. Like, how much more Palestinians should be killed for this genocide to stop?
Is there anything that you think people aren't doing that they can be doing?
No, I don't think it's the people.
Mm-hmm. It's people in power.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So I know that you've been writing a lot of poetry, and I want to hear about when you started writing poetry, but I know that you got a chance to perform recently, some of your writing, and if you don't mind, I would love to hear some. I would love to for you to read some of your poetry with us.
Okay, first I want to tell you, when did I start writing?
Yeah.
I started journaling in general when I was in grade 7. And writing poetry, I don't remember, but I'm a person who daydreams a lot. Like, sometimes the person in front of me is talking and I'm just daydreaming. I don't listen.
So you like telling stories to other people, but you also like telling stories to yourself.
Yeah. So I remember in classes, especially in grade 11 and 12, I didn't used to focus a lot, especially in math. I don't like math. I'm not good at math. So whenever the teacher is explaining stuff and numbers, I don't like numbers. It's too much pressure. I just take out my pen and I start imagining stuff. And if it rained and so on, I start writing. And when I was actually in grade 4 or 5, I used to have a red notebook and I used to write stories in Arabic. And my Arabic teacher used to always see them and correct them. But they were so basic stories. For example, I remember one story. It was about a competition, a school competition, who will decorate the class better. So two different classes were competing. This class won because this class cleaned. You have to clean. Like a basic story. Like I was what? I don't know how old people are in grade four, but I was young. But poetry maybe in middle or high school. But the thing is, I don't have most of the poems that I wrote with me because I used to write like on papers. Not everything was on a laptop. So I don't have many poems now with me, but I will share one.
So before you do that, why did you write? Why did you start writing poetry in particular?
I don't know. I don't think when I do stuff. Like, okay, I think before doing stuff, but sometimes you just do stuff. You don't think.
So, yeah. But were there any other poets or poems that you had heard or seen that inspired
you? Yeah, I've been reading since a young age, so I read many poems. And I think the more you read, the more you get creative, the more you get inspired to write. I love Rupi a lot, okay? And the reason I love her is, I remember when I read her book, Milk and Honey and the Sun and Her Flowers, I always thought that, like, I would never be able to write a poem. Like, people who are poets like you are like, wow, I'd never be like them. There was, like, high expectations for poets in my mind, especially reading for Mahmoud Darwish. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow.
Mahmoud Darwish is
you can favorite. Never beat Mahmoud Darwish. Yes. No one can ever beat Mahmoud Darwish. So whenever I read poets, I'm like, wow, I can never do that. But especially reading Rupi's poems, it made me feel that, yeah, I can write as well. You know, like I can just express my thoughts in a poetic way, then it's a poem.
Yes.
So I started writing. Sometimes I write in Arabic, sometimes I write in English. It depends on my mood. Sometimes I find it easier to write in English because it's my second language. So writing in Arabic makes me cry sometimes, or like it hits because it's your first language. But writing in your second language, you feel kind of distant to it. So it's easier.
It can be more creative in a way.
Maybe.
Yeah, because English is also my second language, and it's now my, I think, probably strongest language. But when I write in English, and when I think about it, I think there's something about learning a new language that allows you to kind of use it as a tool to be creative. You can try different things with it. It feels like it's a paintbrush, and you're painting with it.
This actually makes sense. Languages are powerful. I remember when I was back in Gaza, I used to think, oh my God, why do I only know two languages? I used to think maybe I should have focused on French classes because sometimes I want to describe what's happening, but like I don't have words. I was like, maybe it's the languages. Maybe if I know different languages, I would have been able to describe what's happening more. Or maybe what's happening left me speechless in all languages. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that there's a lot of people with a lot of different languages who were trying to describe what was happening in Gaza and they failed.
So yeah, the situation left everyone speechless. Yes. It's not the languages. Yes.
Let's hear your poem.
Okay. I have this poem. It's called Only in Gaza. Maybe I wrote it in 2021, but this year I added to it. The more is happening to Palestine, the more this poem is expanding. Okay. Only in Gaza. Only in Gaza you sleep counting rockets rather than stars. You wake up, if you woke up, on the sounds of bombs rather than birds. Only in Gaza you sleep not knowing if you'll wake up or how will you wake up. In Gaza you sleep in your house and you wake up under the rubble. In Gaza you sleep with your whole body parts. You wake up missing a hand or a leg. In Gaza you have family and friends. The next day, you are on your own. Only in Gaza, people celebrate birthdays while bombs echo in the background. People welcome you with warm hands and a cup of tea while in a tent. Only in Gaza, despite the pain, people remain not just survivors, but warriors. Yeah, this is one of my favorite poems that I wrote.
That's really beautiful.
Thank you.
I like the way that you ended it on almost a hopeful note that despite all of these experiences that are unique to the life in Gaza, that people become warriors.
Yeah.
That people find a way to become strong even though they're in a place of weakness.
Yeah, everything that's happening just makes Palestinians stronger and more resilient, not weaker. Sometimes it's interesting for me how foreigners view me, not Palestinians. Like Palestinians, they see me as a Palestinian person. It's okay. But people abroad who haven't been to Palestine or to Gaza specifically, they're like, oh my God, she's so strong, she's so powerful. How is she not crying? How are there like sounds of bombs in the background and she just did, like, how she didn't give a reaction? Or like, how is she smiling? Or how is she able to drink a cup of Nescafe and laugh or everything? And I think it's the trauma. And it's my personality as well. I'm a cheerful person, I'm a happy person, I'm an optimistic person. I'm a realistic person, but I like to always focus on the good side, to always focus on the cup that is full, not the empty side. And that's what I was doing even during the genocide. I was always focusing on hope, on the kindness of the people, rather than focusing only on the demolishment and the amputations and everything that's happening. So sometimes I used to think, do people think I'm a psycho that I'm laughing or that I'm smiling? But it's how I cope. I remember once when a hospital was bombed, my colleagues and I, we were there, we were reporting, and my colleague was looking at me and he was like, why are you smiling? We're in a bombed place. There is nothing to smile about. I was like, I'm not smiling. Like, okay, I am smiling, but I'm not. Like, I'm not happy that this happened, but this is how I cope.
This is you. That's your trauma response.
Yeah, I don't like to cry in front of people. Like, I'd never do that. Like, if I've done that, I'll cry at home that I've done that in public. I never posted a video of me crying when I was in Gaza, because I don't want to reach to a point where I'm crying for people to sympathize with me. Like, do you have to see me crying or amputated or killed just to sympathize with me? No, I'd rather you not sympathizing with me rather than you seeing me crying. So that's why I always try to be optimistic, even in the darkest of times.
And so you describe the way that people see you as somebody who's very strong and very resilient. How do you see yourself?
How do I see myself? I see myself as a traumatized Palestinian person. And that's just a trauma response, not a person who is powerful or who is brave or anything. When you're living in a war zone and you're only 22 years old and you experienced all of these struggles, like even before the 7th of October, life was never normal in Gaza. Life was always full of struggles and challenges. I remember missing out on many opportunities just because I couldn't travel. Okay, I traveled out of the Gaza Strip several times, but it's not easy. It takes months of planning, money to pay. It's a long process. So living in Gaza itself is a challenge. So my personality is the result of all the struggles that I went through.
Do you start thinking about yourself differently now that you're outside of Gaza?
I'm not really thinking of anything, Mohammed.
You're not thinking. You're still on automatic.
Yeah, when I think, I'll tell you.
Yeah. So going back to poetry and going back to you writing, because this is not the only poem that you've written, you have other poems. And there is something about poetry that I think is really special. Because it's able to capture an idea, an experience, an image, and you have a lot of really powerful images in your poem that are hard to capture with a report or an article. And there are poems that people that become, I think, a lot bigger than even some of the moments and that they come out of. And I think about Ra'fat al-Arir.
Yeah.
And his poem. And If I May Die, Let It Be a Tale. And just how much power there is in
these words.
A few words that is able to travel so far.
Okay, so I believe in the power of words and poetry a lot in general. And the biggest evidence of that is Ghassan Kanafani. Why would Ghassan Kanafani get assassinated? Because of
how... He was just a poet. He was writing poems.
Because of how powerful his words and his books are.
And Palestinian poetry in particular, I think, has a special place.
Yeah, I'm biased. Palestinian... Yeah. Poetry, or even like the books, Palestinian authors just hit different. I don't know, is it because I'm a Palestinian, I'm biased, or like, is it true? I don't know, but I feel it's the trauma. Wallah, I feel like it's the trauma glow that makes the writing even more powerful.
But there's a sense of purpose. There's a sense people write poetry as a form of resistance in a way.
100%, 100%. I love art in general, like not even poetry, even music and everything. So there are many artists and singers now in Gaza, and I watch videos of them, like during everything that's happening, they're still singing or trying to cheer kids in general. And it makes me so happy, to be honest, like how powerful art is.
And it's also a form of storytelling.
100%.
And so it's different ways to continue telling the story of people that at times don't have voices, they don't have an avenue to share their story.
Of course.
Are you going to keep writing poems?
Yeah. But not only poems.
Yeah.
Okay, so I love storytelling, as you already know, and I love diaries, like writing diaries, writing what's happening and everything. So I also love, like I would want to write a book. Not like a poetry book, but like a book.
A book about your experiences?
Yeah, like a memoir, for example, not a poetry book. Okay, I'm not used to sharing my poems a lot. Like the poems that I shared are like, I don't know, maybe 3, 5. I don't know how many poems I shared. Like I have many unshared poems that I don't know if I'll ever share them or not, because I feel too exposed sharing them, because every poem that I wrote is based on a true story or based on how I felt during that time. Like I already feel exposed enough that I post some of my diary entry and that I posted a lot of my life and how it is. So I don't know if I'll ever have the courage to publish a poetry book.
Yeah. And what do you want to keep writing about? Is there anything in particular, you know, you want to write a memoir, for example? You're going to keep writing poetry. You are now in a place where you are posting a lot of stuff about everything that's happening on a daily basis almost. But do you see your kind of mission a little bit differently?
Yeah. Now I feel so much pressure that I'm on the outside, not on the inside, not in Gaza reporting. Like my mission didn't stop the minute I traveled. No, the minute I traveled, my mission became even harder. And I felt that, okay, maybe it's a good thing now that I'm in the Western world, or maybe it's a good thing that I'm outside of Gaza and that there's a lot I can do. One thing is I love inspiring the youth, especially that I'm also 22 years old. I don't consider myself like an adult. Like I'm just an adult. And I always remember back when I was young watching TV, all the journalists, they were like older than me, like maybe in their 30s or something. So I didn't relate to them as much. But now people or the younger generation is relating to me because they feel she's my age or like she's close to my age. Like I'm going to university and look what she's going through, for example. So I'm working a lot on giving like many talks in universities and schools. Most of it is virtual. I'm glad, even if to a certain point, my message is being delivered to different people from different ages, especially the youth. Because you know how they always say the old will die and the young will forget? Like, no, the young will not forget.
I think if there's anything to be said about Palestinians is that they don't forget.
Exactly. Yeah. And they don't forget.
And they don't forget.
Yeah, they don't forgive and they don't forget. So for me, it's so powerful to talk to the youth because the youth is the future of Palestine or the future of tomorrow, really.
So I think that the last question that I have for you, we've talked a lot about stories and we've talked a lot about different ways of translating stories and the urgency of people's voices and people's experiences. And if you look from an outside perspective, from a big picture perspective, about the story of not just Palestine, but Palestine, what do you want that story to look like? Once that story is complete, what does that story look like?
I want the ending to be Palestine is free. I want the world to visit Palestine, not to Palestinians get out of Palestine. What's something that everyone doesn't understand is Palestinians are getting forcibly displaced. Like I'm not here on vacation, like I'm not in the Maldives, for example. Palestinians are getting forcibly displaced. They're fleeing, they're traveling because they don't feel like getting killed. They don't feel like living in one hand or one leg or like a face and this part of the body. So that's why they're getting forcibly displaced out of their country. But once Palestine is free, I would have loved for like my friends from abroad to come and visit us in Palestine.
Because they don't want to leave.
Yeah.
And you want to go back.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But what scares me is I always think of the day I'll go back, and I always think of how would I feel. Like, I can't imagine now. It's been almost half a year and almost all of Gaza is demolished. Many people that I know got killed. So I can't imagine, like, it will be like a ghost town. I know it will be so hard, but I just want this day to come back. I just want this day to happen.
And until then, you'll keep telling stories.
Of course. Like, I'll keep telling stories forever. I'm excited to be a grandma. I'm only 22, but I'm excited eventually after, I don't know, 40 or 50, not 40 years maybe, to be a grandma, and I'll force my grandchildren to listen to stories.
Yeah, and look how many stories you'll have to share.
I have a lot.
You have a lot.
Yeah.
Palestia, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you for having me.
This episode of The Big Picture is produced by me, Mohammed Hassan, for Middle East Eye. Thank you to Hossam Sarhan for filming and Anas Ala for graphics. And thanks to you for listening. If this episode struck a chord with you, or if you disagreed with what was said, we want to hear from you. So you can reach me on Twitter at Mohammed Was Here, or by email at mh@middleeasteye.org. You can also watch all of our episodes in video format on our YouTube channel. If you like this, please consider giving us a rating, because it goes a long way and helps us reach new audiences. Until next time, salam.